The world is shaking with what's going on with YU. I hope we pull out of it in dignity. We're suffering more in Israel than America, of course. The people involved all live here. And they're very highly visible. You have no idea. Okay. Anyway, on that topic, I don't know. I can't. People ask me what's going on. What can I tell you? Sam knows more about the Gold is Green scandal than I know about this. Gold is Green, I do have an opinion. But with YU, I don't know. Okay, today is Monday. Let me just get the date right. Oh, wow, we're in an auspicious time of the year. Sam?
I apologize for Josh and myself. I just want to apologize for Josh and myself. Can't make it today because we haven't finished anyway.
We're preparing for shit. So one second, you're staying, you're going?
Okay, I just want to apologize.
You want to apologize, okay? If you haven't, Gage isn't the, which Josh? I have two Josh.
Berman.
Gentlemen, I never knew that Rabbi Bednesh was on the level of Rav Soloveitchik, but I guess, dar v'dashav. We're a track. Okay. Today is, let me start again, December 24th, 2012. It's a very auspicious date. It's Monday morning, a beautiful Monday here in Yerushalayim HaKodesh. The world around us is caving in, and thank God everything here is as normal as can be. Last week, as you recall, I trust, we spoke about Rabbi Yaakov Yosef and his attempts and what he tried to do to bring Yiddishkeit to the Lower East Side. Ultimately, what happens on the Lower East Side affects all of America, as we shall see in the coming years, Be'ezrat Hashem. But when all was said and done, the kashrut undermined him. And I made a point in class on, a catchword, the average person is not overly intelligent. The average person, hamon ha'am, they're interested food, drink, making a living, happy family, davening, learn a little Ein Yaakov, a little Mishnayot, but not everyone is a great thinker. And when you come up with a catchword, you capture the masses. So before I got to the Karachba, what the leftists did against Rabbi Yaakov Yosef with the tax on chicken and meat in Russia, and what are you doing in America? So I gave you an example from American history, and for whatever the reason was, I picked up on Dr. Lipson. I thank you for correcting me. It wasn't the mistake of old age; it's when the tongue slips. But I picked up on Grover Cleveland, and I was absolutely right. He was elected president once, then he lost to Chester Arthur, and he was elected again. And in that middle election, they ran against him, Ma, where's my pa in the White House, rah, rah, rah. So far, so good. And then it went on to crush. I can give you other examples. When I was growing up, 1944, I remember the theme was, Roosevelt is in the White House waiting to be reelected, Dewey is in the garbage waiting to be collected. That was the theme then. And there were Tippecanoe and Tyler too. All right. But last week, when I said Grover Cleveland, I said Grover Cleveland Alexander. And no one corrected me outside of my dear friend, Dr. Marty Lipson from Toronto, who is about my age and also has an interest in baseball. So, who is Grover Cleveland Alexander? Hall of Fame, 1938, St. Louis Cardinals, great pitcher, born when Grover Cleveland was president, and he was named after the president. But I promised Marty for correcting me, Yitzhak, I got a bottle for another 2 minutes, forgive me, I know baseball is of no interest to you, but I have, you'll be happy at the end of this year, you become a star. But I got to tell you, one of the greatest moments in baseball history, and boy, there's a lot to be learned from this, and it doesn't make me happy, 1926. This is the year before the greatest team was ever to take the field, the 1927 Yankees. The Yankees are in the seventh game of the World Series with the St. Louis Cardinals. Seventh inning, two out. The Cardinals ahead 3-2. The bases loaded for the Yankees. Tony Lazzari, the hard-hitting, clutch-hitting second baseman, the Italiana, stepping up to the plate, and they bring in Grover Cleveland-Alexander. So you wonder, what's the big deal? He won two games already. He won game number 6. He was a total drunkard. His life ends. It's beyond words what happened to him after he finished pitching. He had to go around with circuses and people would throw darts at him. I don't know what went on. You can check it out. And to make a little money, he drank everything away. He was dead drunk. He was out all night celebrating this win in the 6th game. And here they call him in from the bullpen, and he strikes out Tony Lazzari with the bases loaded and goes on to hold the Yankees scoreless the next 2 innings. The Cardinals take the World Series. From this, you learn that even when you're drunk, sometimes you can do something good. And then I come back to Lakewood. The difference between what I learned in Lakewood and what I see here, God have mercy, in the state of Israel, I don't know about New York, but in the state of Israel, you're not allowed to get drunk on Pesach. That halacha on Purim. Pesach is eichet, a big problem. You can only allowed to use grape juice. Aye, the Rambam says good wine, red wine. Chilul Hashem, what I saw last Purim, I'm still shaking. What I saw in Rehov Rav Berlin. You're not allowed to, we're mavatol, a mitzvah taseh, shevi al taseh, it's only the rabbanim, there's a taisvist, you want to get high, put a shot of liquor into a glass of soda and go to sleep. You won't know the difference between Mordechai and Haman when you're asleep. You'll be yotzei. But when I learned in Lakewood, I remember Simchas Torah in Lakewood. I think that was the only time in my life I ever was drunk. And believe me, I will be as Rav Hashem, I will never be drunk again. But in Lakewood, when the guys got drunk, they were crying, they were sprouting words of Torah, words of Yirat Shemayim, words of Musa. They could grab you and shake you. Du fashteis, du fashteis, was bin leb, was bin dam palmit de lebin, was teist, oime kadin, all of Slabaka came out in Lakewood when they were drunk. So sometimes good things come out. All right, anyway. Back here, my thanks to Dr. Marty Lipson once again for calling my attention. What a Grover Cleveland Alexander. I made a drunken Cardinal pitcher president of the United States. Okay, we can outstun Moshe. It was tragic. And then with the butchers and what went on with Pesach and the money. And yes, if we could learn from here, in an ideal world, kashrut should cost nothing. The English have a very good system. The rabbinate will inspect any establishment, declare it kosher, and they do not charge for it. Labriot. It's they raise their funds at a public affair. But this is running a Jewish community. The same thing with day school education. In America today, you say a person's making $250,000 a year. I was just told on my recent trip to the United States that if you're making $250,000 a year with 4 or 5 children that you have to educate, you're in the poorhouse. Originally, according to the Gemara, what's education? It's a communal responsibility. Whether I have children or don't have children, there has to be a Talmud Torah, there has to be yeshiva, there has to be a tomorrow, there have to be kids being educated. The same thing with the mikveh. Mikveh is not only for the women, for use it. A Jewish community has to have a mikveh before you build a shul. And everyone has to contribute. It has nothing to do with my personal or not personal usage. Okay, but RJJ was outvoted by the intelligent Palabatim. The result was tragic. 1895, he suffered a stroke. His last years, he was bedridden. And finally, in his death, the tremendous riots, what went on in death, that even in death, he couldn't be buried in dignity. Did good things come out of it? Yes, we ended off the share last week, and Avram Karp is absolutely correct. Once, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Nachshon Ben Aminadav jumped into the fire. Other Gedolim came to America. Before Rav Yaakov Yosef, no one dared to come to America. How can you come to America? How can you live there? And he lived there. He survived. He suffered. His son remained the Shomer Shabbos. We'll come to that in a few minutes. Other Gedolim came. And we'll later today get to the Ridbaz, who's the next giant to come. But more than that, right during his funeral, the rabbinate, the Orthodox rabbinate, organized for the first time in the history of the United States. There were rabbanim now all over the United States. They saw what happened to Reb Yaakov Yosef and Josh. They made up their minds. In organization and unity, there is strength. And they organized for the first time. You have the Agudas HaRabbanim, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis, the United States and Canada. We in this room, myself, Rabbi Rubin, we're members of the RCA. RCA is a direct outgrowth of the Agudas Rabbanim, as we will see in a year or two from now. This all goes back to RJJ. So that good came out of it, despite all the Akmas Nefesh on an individual level. Now, let me move ahead, and now let me go back to my friend, acquaintance, a man who has a lot of talent, but if you don't become a trained scholar, you just cause indigestion to those who have a scholarly eye. My friend Rabbi Yonah Landau and Dr. Blau, please convey to him what I'm about to say. Come back to his book, The Rav HaKollel and His Generation. One second, I'm in the wrong place. This we already spoke about. Give me a second. You remember the book, remember what I said about it, remember my critique, and let's come back again and entertain you. First of all, you talk about the book. Everyone has a right to spell their name the way he chooses. I spell Rakefet with two F's. Why do I spell Rakefet with two F's? To perpetuate Rothkopf that had two F's. It's balanced. It looks nice. Aaron Rakefet Rothkopf. I can't give up the Rothkopf name because my original scholarship is published in Rothkopf. So I always have to stick to two names. And both last names are legal. Actually, if you look at my passports, they now read alike. Arnold Edward Rakefet Rothkopf, also known as Aaron Isaac. Everything is in there. So, it's amazing when he refers to Yehuda David Eisenstein, who plays such a big role, he spells his name Eisenstein, E-I-Z-E-N. He refers to his volume that we quoted in class, Otsa Zichronotai, Sefer Zichronot. No, if you're going to look up Sefer Zichronot by J.D. Eisenstein, you're never going to find it. No such person existed. And no such book was ever published. What's even funnier, we refer to Rabbi Dr. Pereira Mendes. Yitzhak, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I think his English name was Henry. But if anyone has a computer, check it out. Pereira Mendes, see what you get as his English name. He was one of the founders of the seminary. Rabbi, Spanish Portuguese. He refers to him as Rabbi Chaim Pereira Mendes. Rabbi Drachman, who we all know as Rabbi Bernard Drachman, becomes Duzber Drachman. Now, I'm sure when they were called to the Torah, the Hitaka was called Chaim, Hitaka was called Dovber, but no one in scholarship knows them by these names. Rabbi Sabato Marias of Mikveh Yisrael, Philadelphia, one of the big founders of the seminary. He was older than Pereira Mendes. Pereira Mendes later joins Yeshiva Shibiskol Hanan when the seminary starts becoming conservative. But Rabbi Marias was no longer alive. He refers to as Dr. Shapsai Morris. Sabato Marias becomes Dr. Shapsi Morris. All right, this is not scholarship, but here I'll show you the Haredi world and what they do with their censorship, which turns into absolute stupidity. Now, watch, you'll see something unbelievable. Dr. Shapsi Morris, okay. Excuse me? I quoted it to you. I gave you the source. I believe, one second, here it is. Yeah, it's self-published. It was not edited. He evidently wrote it in Yiddish. It was translated into English. Neither he nor the translator knew what scholarship is all about. What's that invaluable about the book? Have you ever seen it? It's kedai to look at. What's invaluable about the book? He republishes all the articles in the New York Times and all the contemporary papers on everything about RJJ. So you have the computer right before your eyes in a book. Everything you would have to research and kill yourself finding and search engines, he has it there. So this much I can tell you, he knows computers. Anyway, so I was right, thank you. Okay, Baruch Hashem, my memory is working. So I'm proud. I'll make a note of it. Henry. That's what I thought it was, Henry. But I want to put it into my notes. Henry. Okay, thank you. Now, gentlemen, Yeshiva University along the years has published many scholarly journals. Its most famous scholarly journal is Talpiyot. It's no longer published for many decades. But at one time, this was a scholarly journal of scientific Jewish scholarship on a very high level and in total consonance with Torah Hashem Tamima. Why is Talpiyot so famous? No, who can help me out? We only breathe air because of the 1944 issue of Talpiyot, where Mori Urebi Rab Soloveitchik broke with Brisker tradition and published the first article he would publish, and the greatest article he would ever publish, Ish HaHalacha. It was published in Talpiyot. In parentheses, why did Mori Urebi publish? Why did he break with Brisker tradition? So I'll give you Rakepet's theory. Two reasons. I challenge you to prove me wrong. One, at that time he was just coming into his own at what becomes Yeshiva University. All of you know, if you've studied Rakepet's writings on the Rav, and if you've watched the DVD, the biography of the Rav, the documentary that our little guy from the Bronx was privileged to bring into the world. So you know that there was a tremendous fight over the Rav becoming the Rosh Yeshiva of what today becomes YU. There was plenty of opposition, and he had to establish himself. So by publishing Ish Halacha, the world now knew, or I'll put it this way, JB turned into the Rav. Okay, do you read me? Because when the Rav first came to the yeshiva, everyone called him JB. Joseph Baer was a young guy. The students have big mouths, can be fresh at times. Am I right or wrong, Moshe? And they called him JB. That article, that's the start of JB turns into the Rav that very year. I have more to say in it, but that's one reason. Excuse me? No. Nothing to do with youth. You're missing Rakepet's lectures. Go back. Spend a few years. Don't waste time with life. Ellie, what you have to do is take off 7 years. Lock yourself in a room and just listen to some of the choice offerings on the YU website. I don't have to push myself. You'll find good stuff. And at the end of 7 years, you'll be able to function in the world as a Jew and as a great human being. Okay, but until then, opposition to the Rav. Years. No, not Haredi. The Kashrut scandal, the Agudas HaRabbanim. Yeah, what you call in popular language, Haredi. Haredi, the word didn't exist then. Gentlemen, the second reason is there's a big difference. You see, the Rav, when you talk about Bris, when you have a difficult Rambam, there's only one way to fend for that Rambam. And we always struggle. Are we right? How we hit the truth. When it comes to philosophy, how many of you have studied philosophy? There are so many different approaches to philosophy. Philosophy blends into theology, blends into hashkafa, call it what you wish. Tell me, who is right? Who is right? Everyone is right, everyone is wrong. Some are right, some are wrong. There's no absolute truth there. So there you can publish. You follow me? It's not like a Briska who's overwhelmed. Oh, I may not be right, they're going to kill me. So the Rav published Isha Halacha. Those are my two theories. Take it or leave it. I may be right, I may be wrong. Once again, it's a theory. I'm not trying to bring a Shvera Rambam now. Okay. Tal Piyot was a very fascinating publication. Look in to the 8th volume, and it's Choveret Gimel Dalet, 1963. And you find in that volume, unbelievable what they came up in archives. They came up with two letters of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. The letters were published, the letters were edited, published in the Talpiyot, edited by a scholar, Chaim Reuven Rabinovitz. He was one of these Chachmat Yisrael people in New York, a first-rate scholar. Now, the letters are fascinating, but before I tell you about the letters, you look in to HaRav HaKolel, Landau's book, who the letters were addressed to, were crossed out. It's missing. It was censored. Wow. Why? Why did he censor it? Because who were the letters addressed to? Reb Shmuel Yosef Finn. Reb Shmuel Yosef Finn, if any of you know the history of Vilna, he was the head of the Strashun Library. He was a first-rate Talmud Chacham. He was a Yerusha Mayim 1,000%. But he was a Maskel. He knew general literature. He knew the modern Haskalah literature. He had a very broad vista. So Landau evidently thought he wasn't from. He left his name out. It's beyond words. The man, I knew people who yet knew him, said, Tzadik Yisod Olam. Reb Lezer Silva used to go into the Vilna library when he learned Reb Chaim Moses Kibbutz 110 years ago. He went into the library, and when the librarian couldn't help him with a difficult sefer, she referred him to Reb Shmuel Finn. And Finn found a Sfarim for him. He was a tremendous Yodeya Sefer. Left the name out. By the way, in parentheses, once again, I'll throw around a little knowledge that you will enjoy. Reb Lezer Silva got a lot more out of the library than just books. He married the girl who gave him the books. A young lady behind the desk, she was the librarian, caught his eye. A real beautiful love story. And by the way, that's one of the reasons he went off to America, because who ever heard in Europe, son of Reb Tzemach Biunim, a Litvish Rav, that you get married on a pickup instead of a shirach? Shmuel, there's a lot to learn from there. If Reb Lezer Silva could do it on a pickup, a lot of the young men that I'm teaching should have the guts to pick up the girl and take it further. Now, what are the letters about? The letters are very revealing. The first letter was written right after he came to the United States. And it's a very long letter. By the way, you can find it on websites. If you knock in Finn, perhaps, I don't know exactly how you can get through Google, but it's discussed on websites. The first letter, Rav Yaakov Yosef is describing what he has found in America. Such kavod haTorah, such awe, and he describes how at his initial drasha, the police had to pave a way for him to get in to the synagogue. He describes how he went to the bathhouse, and remember, those are days before you had, today we have showers in our house. I once asked my mother, Zichrona Levracha, what was the greatest invention of her lifetime? She said indoor plumbing. It's very fascinating. I say, people ask, what's the greatest invention in my lifetime? I don't know. Computers, perhaps. Someone older than me would say airplanes. Whoever dreamt we could travel all over the world within hours? But indoor plumbing. So he went to the public bathhouse. He describes it. The word spread that the chief rabbi was in the public bathhouse. Thousands of East Side Jews gathered outside the bathhouse. When the chief rabbi wanted to come out to walk home, they had to call police to escort him. So this is very fascinating. It reveals a mindset. When did you see police in Eastern Europe? When there was a pogrom, when they were beating the hell out of the Jews. And here, Kanayin Hara, the chief rabbi, comes to America. The police surround him. The police help him. The police are so reverential. And in that first letter, he describes already what he wants to do with Kashrut and what he wants to do and build up Rabriyut, build up proper Talmud Torah. And he's so upbeat. A few months later, he writes a second letter and he apologizes. He barely has time. He's overwhelmed. It's very difficult. It's like moving mountains. And you see that the Magid Meshurim of Vilna, who had been so friendly with this Reb Shmuel Finn, who ran this Trashun library, this was all wiped out by Hitler. This is all a world gone by. The Magid Meshurim is writing to his friend, but the second letter already, he's not dancing. He's not upbeat. He's not enthralled. No other letter exists to Reb Shmuel Finn. There may have been letters, but the archives don't have them. Now, there's another very interesting point in the Rav HaKollel. And here, I have to thank him because Avram Karp does not go into this. This already is getting us involved in what Yitz Rubin yelled at me. What are you playing God? Who are you to give reasons? It's the old story of when we try to do tshuva and try to understand what happened and try to understand Sandy. So, Vayido Maharon, it's better to keep quiet in public because right away you're playing God. He tells the whole story of the disgrace of the bidding for the body, everything I told you about. And had Beit Midrash HaGadol says, we brought him to America. If we brought him to America, we want to bury him. He describes how they give $1,500 to the widow, $15 a month, immediately the Sarenson family. I was there. I saw it. Buys up all the graves. Next thing, they made back all their money within minutes. Beginning on page 476, this is something I didn't know. What was the end of the whole company? Were they ever punished for their brutality? In the end, justice was visited upon the whole company from heaven for their violence at the Rav HaKollel's funeral. In 1904, the owners of whole company took their employees on a boat ride aboard the ferry General Slocum. I believe Slocum was a Civil War hero, which cruised the Hudson River. When the boat was only 100 feet from shore, a raging fire suddenly broke out, quickly enveloping the ship in flames. The terrified partygoers on the ship began to shout for help, but it was too late to reach them. Within moments, the fire had engulfed the entire ship, claiming hundreds of victims. There were no survivors aboard the doomed ship. The newspapers that reported the tragedy were quick to claim that this was the heavenly retribution for the company's role in the riots of Rabbi Jacob Joseph's funeral. And so it was. All right. Fascinating detail, the Slocum going down. I do recalling seeing that in history books. And he makes the claim that the R&H Hull Company, it was an outing for the workers. Now, beginning on page 45, he goes through what remained of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef's family. And here it's very sad. Rabbi Rafal, who evidently came to America on his own, because we only know that passage was paid for Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, his wife, and two daughters. Rabbi Rafal evidently was older. He came to America on his own. His son was Lazarus Joseph, who was the New York State Controller, or the New York City Controller. And Lazarus Joseph was the Shomer Shabbos. His son was the one that was killed in World War II, and evidently nothing remains of that family. If the old RJJ building is still standing, I remember that the playground next to it, a city playground, was named in memory of the grandson who was killed in World War II. He claims that this son was also a Shomer Torah mitzvah. The fate of the Rav HaKolel's daughters is unclear. Rav Ephraim Mushri, now, do you know who Rav Ephraim Mushri was? You should know him from my Sunday classes. We spent many years quoting his Shirat and Shivat Min HaMa'amakim. Rav Ephraim Mushri was a survivor who I once called, people are always out to shtek you. You know, it's an amazing thing. People ask me, Rebbe, how do you keep so young? You know how I keep so young? It dawned upon me, paraphrasing a Gemara. I'm never negative. Have you heard me been negative? I mean, more or less, 90% of the time, positive. With Reb Baron Cutler, I can't believe the scuttlebutt and the websites that Rabbi Rakefet gave a two-hour talk on Reb Baron Cutler, and not one negative word about Reb Baron Cutler. What are these people, morons? He doesn't agree with Rabbi Hashkafer. He doesn't say, Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm going to say a negative word about Reb Baron Cutler. I remember once getting up to speak of Moshe Feinstein in front of hundreds of people in Florida, and a kid with a black hat cuts me off as I'm going to the podium. Are you for or against? I say, what do you mean, for or against? You're not wearing a black hat, moron. That's what your Rebbeim told you? Wash their mouths out with soap. Ribbono Shel Olam. You have to be positive. So Reb Ephraim Mushri, I did a monograph. It's in Rakafet Aaron Chelik Aleph. I did a monograph on Reb Avram Dov Berg Anishpira. I call him the last rabbi of Kovna. So someone writes in that I made a terrible mistake. The last rabbi of Kovna was Reb Ephraim Mushri. That's not exactly right. After World War II, he was the survivor. He was in Kovna till he went to America. So he was the rabbi. But to say he was the last rabbi, there was no community left, nothing left. So you got to be careful. You have to be positive. Give someone the benefit of the doubt. If I called the problem, don't be honest with last rabbi of Kovna. I think I was correct. So he becomes rabbi of the Beis Medrash HaKotel. When he became rabbi of the Beis Medrash HaKotel, remember there were many people still alive in America who knew RJJ. We're talking now the late 40s, let's say. Now, I still knew people who knew RJJ where I got them in the Bronx, Halakha Kama Vakama, the Beis Medrash HaKotel on the east side, Joni. So he related that one of Rav Yaakov Yosef's elderly daughters begged to meet him. He traveled to see her in a village in Long Island, a village, you know, what do you call it, a town, a township, what would we call it, not a village. I wouldn't call Lawrence, I don't know where, Woodmere, other places, a village. He traveled to see her in a village in Long Island where she lived alone and embittered. The elderly woman complained about her father's situation and how he had been abandoned in his final years. Rav Ashri was heartbroken to see her distress so many years later, as she described the poverty and deprivation in their home. She was angry with all of American Jewry for ignoring her father and her family in their time of need. And I have to tell you, I react very sadly to this little story, because I am 99% positive. It is absolutely correct. And I can just tell you that in my own experience with my research on Rabbi Revel And I have to be modal HaKadosh Baruch Hu that Mrs. Revel was ma'aricha yamim and was able to help me with the do the research and give me material on her late husband. The same would apply. She was very bitter, very bitter. And she felt that Yeshiva University had neglected her husband's memory, that the world of Torah that he built, no one gave him credit. And I have to tell you, there's a lot of truth to it. This is something about our world that we can learn from the Haredi world, the term that Danny used or Ellie used. You can learn from the Haredi world. They give credit. Look at Art Scroll, look at those volumes, and they're republished, and no one has to go begging for money. I give them credit. In our world, the average kid at Yeshiva University today not only doesn't know the name of Rabbi Revel, he doesn't know the name of Rabbi Belkin. I mean, and just think. And you don't know what these people did against all odds. You don't know how they changed the course of Torah history. Okay, Art Scroll censors it like Landau censored Finn. But Yeshiva College, why you? And I can appreciate these words. Here is RJJ's daughter in her old age. Whoever heard of RJJ? Look at the way he lived. Look at the way he died. Look how much he suffered. And the daughter has every right to be embittered. Maybe we can learn from that. If the Gedolei Yisrael, we know we should kiss their hands and figuratively and literally and do what we can that we should be Makir Tova to those on whose shoulders we stand.
But you see how Hashkafa okay. works. He who forgot to write or to have the YU English, the history department write biography don't, he will be forgotten too.
Okay, let's forget. Don't maledict contemporary people. Yeah, but everyone knows what you're saying. It's a sad story, and this scandal, I can't believe what's gone on. How it's if you saw the papers on Friday and the investigative reporting, and like a snowball rolling down a mountain, and you ask yourself, can it be true? Can it be true? I've asked students of mine from the 60s and the 70s, and you're just flabbergasted. And if it is true, if people knew, why didn't they act? And then people say, well, it was a different climate then, a different climate. It may be true. It may be true with a different climate. I know in Machon Gold, I don't want to waste time, but I know in Machon Gold, I once had an incident in the early 70s. A girl, a student, not a girl, a lady. She, you went to Israel much older at the time, your third year college or after college. And I remember she once came over to me with tears and she said, Rebbe, I must talk with you. We went into the teacher's room. And she tells me some faculty member made some very terrible sexist comment to her. And she was like shaking. And a rabbi, and this there was a YU graduate who may believe he never went to YU, to use the word Haredi, Chas v'Chalila, should mention he's a YU musmach. And I calmed her down, and I helped her, and I remained very friendly with her, and I always gave her chizik. And she went on, today she's married into a very famous Haredi family. When I come to that community, I don't want to mention the city, she gives me covered malachim, and people can't understand the noisvav, ha-shegit v'ratefet, a religious Zionist, the Talmud of the Rav, and he's proud of being a religious Zionist. And no one knows the real story. But you see, I said to Malk, I said to my wife, you know what's interesting? I never dawned upon me to go to the dean and say to the dean, you get rid of that mamza. This is what he said to this lady. I'll bring her into the office. Well, it's me or him. Never dawned upon me. You understand what I'm saying? Today, if I were teaching in Machon Gold and something like that happened, I'd go to the dean and say, we got a maneuver on the faculty. Turned out his whole family, there's a whole history in the family. I bite my lips. You know too much, it's not good either. Follow me? It's a pasuk in Kohelet. Too much knowledge, not good. Okay, but you follow me? It may be true. That the 1970s, 80s, you didn't think of going to the police. The same thing is going on in Yeshiva College in Melbourne. And I have to tell you, they dragged in Rabbi David Groner's name. I knew Rabbi Groner. He was a gonadir. He was a tzaddik. He built Australia. He was a Chabadnik. All of Australia is Chabad. Wherever there's Yiddishkeit, even the Mizrahi is two-thirds Chabad. Everyone is Chabad there. He built it. He was a Gaon, knew how to paskin. I don't use these words lightly. And I know I knew the whole Groner family. His nephew was my best friend, Svi Zecher Tzadik Livracha. His brother with Leibel was the Rebbe's right hand. And Yaakov Groner was Makariv me when I came in Aliyah in 69. His wife, Betty, took Malka to show her how to shop here. How can you pay back people for their kindness like that when you're a stranger in a strange land? You know, today I'm a big shot in Israel. I'm living here 44 years. There's, you know, there's nothing you can tell me about Israel. But in 69... So they dragged him. There was this pedophile. He remained. He didn't call the police. He said, we'll treat it with psychologists. Maybe that was what went on then. They didn't call the police. They didn't think that way. It's a different world today. So I want to be Melamed Zchut and Rabbi Lam and all the scuttlebutt against him. What do you want out of him? It was a different era. And of course, he asked Rabbi Miller to take over. Okay, we're not going to solve it. I say what I said last week, what they said to Joe Jackson. Say it ain't so, Joe. Gentlemen, we have arrived at one of the most fascinating chapters in American Torah history, the Ridbaz. When I got my doctorate, I told you the story. I now put it into context. So you have to defend your doctorate, an oral defense. So I defend my doctorate, and I'm outside the room sweating, worried. All the big professors are inside making a decision. Rabbi Landa opens the door and invites me back in, and he says, Arnold, we're happy to tell you we're awarding you your doctorate. You've defended your thesis. And one of the members of the faculty pops up, and Rabbi Rothkopf, we know this will be your last piece of scholarship because rabbis never do scholarship. So I heard that, and I don't know, I always accepted a challenge. And that's 67, 68. I did postdoctoral research on the Ridbaz, published it in a very prestigious publication, and even won a prize for it. Now, you talk about the Ridbaz, even before I mention his name, I want to give you a very fascinating source, and I'm in debt to my student, Joshua Schneider of West Hempstead, who made a copy of this rare book for me. And it all comes about because of my lectures on the Holocaust. I cited the Sri Deyesh writing a tshuva to someone named Landau, and Rab Menachem Mendel Landau. And the Sri Deyesh says about this Landau, I'm quoting to you from the new edition of the Sri Deyesh, Chelik Bet, page Shin Yud Chet. He says that this Landau hitztayeng b'yediyot tov rabot b'chol machmanei chamada ha'ivri gadol day of a ruach meyechidei eskula shebedoro b'nei doro lo amdu agat luto. He was a rav, and you know, in Eastern, he was a rav, and the world didn't know how to appreciate this Menachem Mendel Landau. The name of the city, I can't even pronounce it. Let me see if I can get it right. Zavishnitsria. Zavishnitsria must be in the Romanian Czechoslovakian area at that time. Must be roots from Hungary. And by the way, his great-grandson, I write about in my book, Lo Aleinu in Washington, that is Yair Landau, the Hesdi Yeshiva boy, who was killed in the war in 1982. If you recall, there's a passage in Washington, how we came in Aliyah on the boat, and on the boat, these little children at play, and Nebuch, one of those little children, Yair Landau, would give his life in defense of Israel. And Yair Landau's father was a grandson of this Reb Menachem Mendel Landau. So it's ultimately a small world. Now, he put out a volume called Mekitz Nidamim, published in 1904. And in this volume, on page 132, and I read the whole volume, it's a fascinating volume. It deals with rabbinic assemblies when the rabbanim from Greater Hungary came together and they're trying to decide what to do and how to influence the generation. And he speaks, and you see, very broad-minded, that we have to educate, we have to teach women. And you should know Rav Teitz's uncle, Rabinovich, who was editor of Hapeles, rips the hell out of him at the convention. We're going to teach women. What are we, reformers? Women don't have to learn, don't have to know anything, just what their parents tell them, like the Erech HaShulchan. Remember in my Sunday class, I dealt with it a few weeks ago. And he rips him apart. That's Rabbi Teitz's uncle. And Rabbi Teitz later goes on, you know, that men and women were basically equal in Rabbi Teitz's educational system, somewhat like the Rav's point of view. And Rav Landau is very forward-looking. And on page 132, he speaks about that we must educate all the Jews. And we can't give up on the Jews that left Eastern Europe and went to the far corners of the earth. And he has a beautiful description here. What do we want out of them? They were starving here. It's not that they ran away because they're angry at God or angry at the religion. They ran away because here they had starvation and deprivation. And in America, they were able to establish themselves. And therefore, listen to these words, Aleinu larutz achareichem. We have to run after them. We have to bring them back to Torah mitzvot in America, in Canada, in England, in South Africa. The author of the Ridbas on the Yerushalmi is going to Chicago, the second greatest Jewish community in the United States, and I am overjoyed. Ki Rav Gadol b'Yisrael kamohu, someone as great as he is, betach yuchal letaken shem habei. He'll be able to do wonders in Chicago. Now, I got to tell you, and I thank Joshua Schneider again, that quote from Rav Landau opens your eyes. First of all, it shows you Rav Landau, how open he was. Go to America. We have to run after them. It's not like the Chafetz Chaim. What did the Chafetz Chaim say at the end of Nidchei Yisrael? No, help me out. What did the Chafetz Chaim say? I quoted in the souvenir, I translated into English. Come back to Europe. Leave America. You made enough money already. If you want your kids to be Jewish, only here in Eastern Europe. Landau, we have to run after them to America. And he's overjoyed that the Ridbas, what he'll be able to accomplish in Chicago. And he, and you know, Landau knows Chicago, I believe until today, is the second largest Jewish community in the United States. It may be today Los Angeles overtook Chicago. You tell me. You don't know. Anyone else from Chicago? You're also from Chicago. Los Angeles, I think, is bigger. But in terms of Torah institutions, Chicago is still the second hub of Torah. And you have Tells there, which is successful. It's not like Tells in Cleveland today. You have Skokie there, you know, with all the pros and cons. But you have Skokie, you have Tells, Ida Crown. You have a world in Chicago. L.A., do you have anything on that higher level? No. You have Yeshiva Gavoa, you have Haredim, you have some Hasidim. But you don't have a real institution that compares, certainly nowhere near YU, and certainly not even near Skokie, or Tells, for that matter. Okay. Gentlemen, we have arrived, the Ridbas. May I quote my own scholarship. Rakefer Aron, Chelik Bet. I'm quoting from page 154 through page 169. Now, the Ridbaz's years, first of all, the name, let's give the name. Ridbaz, Rabbi Yaakov David Ben Zev. It's an acronym, Rid Baz. Moshe, his last name was Wilowski. W-I-L-L-O-W-S-K-I. Anyone named Wilowski, you'll find out, is related to the Ritbaz. His name Wilowski has been forgotten because he used the acronym Ritbaz, and the Ritbaz knocked out Wilowski. His years, just to put him into context, 1845-1913. Now, he was raised in White Russia, and he was an Eloi, photographic memory. A photographic memory is a gift from God. When you've seen people with a photographic memory, it's very, very frightening. I've seen a guy named Rabbi Cohn, Yehoshua Cohn, I think his name is. He literally knows every Tosfot in Shas, line by line by line. Shaskon. I've heard of his. My son-in-law is very close. My son-in-law goes to his shir every day. And my son-in-law turned 50. He made a party, and the party was Rav Cohn would come to speak, and Rav Cohn would made it conditional on my being there. So you can be proud of your Rebbe, even though I'm far from a genius like that. But I was able, what he was talking about, I threw in a tziv, Meshiv Dov, he couldn't believe his ears, a support, and I Xeroxed to him the next day, sent it to my son-in-law to say, give to him. He's a very fascinating individual, Rabbi Yehoshua Cohn, Shas Cohn. No, that's a blessing. The problem is, when you're a genius like that, how do you deal with the normal world? All geniuses are haunted by this, I would say, this duality. I think it's a good word. I don't have to go far abreast. You take Reb Chaim Zimmerman. His biography just came out. I want to order it for the Kollel and Yeshurin. I have to talk with Rav Asaf Bednash. His biography just came out. And in the review of the Yeshurin that has the biography, it says, I couldn't believe my eyes. In the latest Ma'ayan from Shalavim, Yeshivat Shalavim, he never found his place in life. It's like they're quoting Rakefet. Reb Chaim Zimmerman was a genius of geniuses, but you got to be tied down to normalcy. It's very difficult for a genius. The Rav, I can tell you about the Rav that Rebbetzin Tanya, Zichrono Levracha, turned the Rav into a mortal. Okay, you like the way I said it, Yitzchak? She turned the Rav into a mortal. Had the Rav not married Tanya, I don't know if he would have ever found his place in life. He was a genius. A genius can't deal with ordinary foibles of plain, simple mortals. The Ritbaz, to a certain degree, never was able to find his total place in life. He always suffered from his unbelievable genius. On the other hand, the fact that he was such a genius is perhaps why he was foolish enough to accept the challenge to go to Chicago. You follow what I'm saying? Could be someone more sedate, more down to earth, would have said, Mali Ulitzarezu, the rabbinic aphorism. And he, what could he do, Daniel? He was a genius. There's a challenge. Moshe. He took it. But before he went to Chicago, his life is very, very interesting, and at least I owe him a great debt of gratitude, as you will see in one moment. He is a well-known Rav, ultimately comes to the rabbinate of Slutsk. Slutsk was a very important rabbinate. It was the rabbinate of the Beit HaLevi, Rabbi Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, before he went to Brisk, and he and becomes Slutsker Rav, publishes Shelet and Shuvat, and then he wants to establish a yeshiva in Slutsk, 1896. At that time, the biggest yeshiva, the yeshiva that had taken the place of Volozhin that closed down in 1892 by governmental order, the Slabodka Yeshiva, is the hub of Torah. Who established the Slabodka Yeshiva? Who put it on the map? Rav Natan Tzvi Finkel. A doctorate has just been done about him, a brilliant doctorate at Hebrew U by Reb Shmuel. I think his first name is Shmuel Tukachinsky. It's from the Tukachinsky family. A brilliant, brilliant doctorate on the Alta of Slabodka, on the whole concept of Slabodka. Now, the Alta, what was fascinating about Slabodka, it was not a yeshiva, it was a movement. It cared about Klal Yisrael. What am I saying? Could you imagine Landa College turned to Rabbi Lam and said to Rabbi Lam, look, we began a yeshiva here, we began a yeshiva college, we need some good students to put the Beit Medrash on the map. Could you send us 10, 12, 14 top students? What do you think Yeshiva University would have said to Landa College? Danny, I will let you express it. I don't want to express it. I don't want to issue a malediction that the microphone might pick up. You got it, Shmuel? Go fly a kite. We should help you. You're cutting into our panasa. Ah, because Yeshiva University views itself as a very elite, unique institution. Slabodka, whenever a new yeshiva was established, the Alta sent some of the best students lechazek otam. In 1896, the Alta sent the Yad Chazaka to Slutsk. Yad 14 of the top students. Among them, Rabisa Zalman Meltzer, who was one of the top students to come out of Lushan. He and his brother-in-law, Reb Mordechai Moshe Repstein, both married into the Frank family of Kovna. The Frank family was a very wealthy family. The father died young, and he left the tzavar that all his money should be used for his four daughters to get them wonderful husbands. Levush Mordechai, Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, Rabbi Baruch Horowitz, the Akshata Rav, Rav Levin, Rav Sheftel Kramer was the fourth son-in-law, if I'm not mistaken, who later goes to New Haven and organizes, the first yeshiva on a high level outside of New York in New Haven, Connecticut, where Rabbi Belkin gives Shiurim 1930-1931. That's his first formal position in the United States, a Rosh Yeshiva in New Haven. New Haven later winds up from Cleveland. Cleveland, it goes to Baltimore, and in Baltimore, Reb Sheftel Kramer's son-in-law, Rav Ruderman, Rav Yaakov Yitzchak Ruderman, becomes the Rosh Yeshiva and puts Ne'er Yisrael on the map. And we'll be, are you graduates of Ne'er Yisrael? And Charlie, did you know? But Baltimore, Ne'er Yisrael, and the whole city today dances to the tune of Ne'er Yisrael in Baltimore. That was the Frank family. How else do you know the Frank family? Yaakov, Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank, Rabba Shel Yerushalayim, was a cousin to these girls. He was the son, I believe, of a brother of their father, or a grandson. A son. Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank. That's the Frank family. Wow. So among the Yad Chazakah is Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. I want to tell you, a Haredi author once wrote in one of his books that the Baron Cutler was among the Yad Chazakah sent from Slabodka to Kletsk. So I wrote him a nice letter, not cynically, but I said I knew Rabaron was a great Eloi, but I don't believe someone born in 1892 would go to, you know, was on the high enough level to go from Slabodka to Slutsk at the age of four. You follow? I never got an acknowledgement. It's the kind of thing, if someone corrects me, I'm the happiest person alive. You saw, all right, a correction on Grover Cleveland, that's not a big correction. That's a slip of the tongue. But it's a fascinating psychology that Marty Lipson picked up, that why he hit the nail on the head. The minute I said Grover Cleveland, automatically, the only Grover Cleveland I know is Grover Cleveland Alexander. What I know about the other Grover, I don't know about any World Series with him.
Your knowledge of baseball took you off
Off the web. But if someone corrects me, you know, on a real mistake, I'm the happiest guy alive. I never got it. Thank you for your correction. I will correct it in the next edition. You are correct. It is Yad Chazaka. Until today, there's an endless debate exactly who the 14 people were. All right. Now, they organize the yeshiva in Slutsk, and Rabbi Zalman becomes the Rosh Yeshiva. Why is this so important? Why am I bowing my head to the Ritbaz? Why? He organized that yeshiva. He wrote in the Yad Chazakah. The Alt of Slobodka sent them. They built the yeshiva. It became a very well-known yeshiva. Then Reb Issa Zalman Meltzer was looking for a son-in-law for his daughter. His daughter, Bela Hinda, very brilliant lady. Very intelligent lady. No, that's his wife, Bela Hinda. Excuse me. It was Pearl. His daughter was Pearl. Pearl. He was looking for a shidduch. She was a bright girl, had a very bright mother. The mother was so bright that she assisted Rabbi Zalman with his chidushim. She copied them over from his handwriting, prepared them from publication, edited them. These were very bright women, the Frank girls. They were not simple people. These were great people, knowledge, Yirat Shemayim. No, he's looking for a son-in-law. So the Alt of Slobodka tells him, I have a young man for you. He's not a tzaddik, but he's a gon adir. But that kumen at sight, that the world will suffer from his sitkit. The time will come, the world will suffer. What was this name of the young man? Reb Aaron Kotla. And of course, Reb Natan Kamenetsky got into a lot of trouble for writing about the shidduch and the letters. And boy, what the Haredi world can pick on, it's beyond words. Again, I don't have time. You got to hear Rakefet Shia. I hope it's someplace on the website where I explain what I believe were the letters that Reb Aaron Kotla wrote to his sweetheart, to Pearl Meltzer, who shortly thereafter becomes his wife. There's more to it. The Schumann family gets involved. Are you aware of that? They quote one of your uncles as saying he saw these letters and it was a list of Russian books that Reb Aaron suggested she should read. Because Reb Aaron was a big bucking in Russian literature. Again, you have to hear Rakefet's talk at YU. Listen to it. It's a few weeks ago. It's not ancient history. So they quote your uncle who saw the letters he claims. Wow. Unbelievable. Gentlemen, Reb Aaron Kotla comes to Slutsk. Great Eloy. Slutsk is on the map. It attracts some of the top Talmidim in all of Eastern Europe. For instance, Reb Elio Henkin, Rav Menachem Man Shach, Slutsk, Rav Palayev, Moshe Aaron Palayev, Slutsk. World War I comes. Terrible. Yeshiva's on the battle line. Communist takeover. You can't remain in White Russia anymore. Rabbi Zalman, who was a great Ohev Eretz Yisrael, along with the Levush Mordechai, 1925, goes on Aliyah to become the Rosh Yeshiva of Eitz Chaim in Yerushalayim, which was then the premier yeshiva. And all you had in Yerushalayim was the Yishuv HaYashan. It was the premier yeshiva of the Yishuv HaYashan, Eitz Chaim. Rabbi Zalman's the Rosh Yeshiva. He leaves Slutsk in the hands of Reb Aaron. But you can't keep the yeshiva in White Russia. The yeshiva moves to Kletsk, Poland. And Reb Aaron is now the Kletska Rosh Yeshiva. Is that where your grandfather learned?
My father-in-law.
Your father-in-law learned in Kletsk. And your grandfather? Slobodka. Yeah, it's all this yichus is looking at me now. All this yichus is staring at me. Baruch Hashem. So you know what I'm telling you? Tell the boys, I'm not making it up. These are the facts. Now, Reb Aaron, watch. The Ritbaz is now out of the picture. He moves on to America, America to Israel, Israel, Palestine, and I should say. He dies 1913. Kletz, the Baron, fabulous yeshiva. World War II, the Baron is saved, gets to America, San Francisco, 1941. The boat docks, goes by train across America, comes to New York, greeted at Penn Station. Kletz Goresh Yeshiva, 49 years old. Malei Hagadosh, terrific mind. Throws himself totally, completely, wholly into Hatzalah work. Argues, yells, shouts, fights. This chapter has to be written in more detail. It's already been written very nicely by Ephraim Zuroff. But we still have more documents that keep on popping up. The first one to touch upon it was the individual who wrote on Reblazer Silva. There's a whole chapter in the Silva era. But he didn't have access to the archives yet. They were sequestered. But later, they make available the Varatzala archives, and Ephraim Zuroff does a beautiful job. By the end of 42, it was obvious nothing further could be done. Who you saved. Everyone else left behind was condemned to death. Lo aleinu. The world, I mean, Roosevelt, they didn't bomb up. I don't have to tell you. You all know the history. At that point, there were a handful of European yeshiva boys in New York. A handful American-born, most of them refugees. And they wanted a real yeshiva like they knew in the old home. YU was too secular for them. Torah Vadas was not on a level. So they opened up something in White Plains. A little yeshiva. You don't understand. You're gaining knowledge. And they made Reb Mendel Zaks the Rosh Yeshiva. Reb Mendel was the Chafetz Chaim's son-in-law. He was saved in 41 as well. Saved by Rabbi Rebel, by papers that Yeshiva, what today's Yeshiva University sent. He lived on the west side, and he commuted to White Plains, and it didn't catch on. So the same group gathered around the Baron and pleaded with him, open up a yeshiva, take over White Plains. And the Baron decided, gotta leave New York. Got to go where there's no influence of a big city. A big city is very disturbing. As you know, the tradition of all yeshiva was to be in a suburb. Sabatka was a suburb of Kovna.
Are we dealing with Ridbaz now or about
Kovna? We're going to come back to the Ridbaz in a minute, but I have to show you what we owe the Ridbaz. I know what I'm doing. So Rabaran decided, let me get away from New York. He chose Lakewood. Why he chose Lakewood, I'll go into great detail when I deal with Reb Aaron. It's not for now. But on a popular level, suffice it to say, you're away from the big city. And in 1942, 43, actually 43, Lakewood began. It's a whole machloket, whether it was 13 students or 14 students, was exactly this nucleus. The rest is history. So that when you talk about the Ridbaz, it's not just what he did in Europe. He gave us Lakewood. Lakewood Yeshiva is really Kletzk Yeshiva. Kletzk Yeshiva is really Sklutz. Sklutz is really the Ridbaz. And the Ridbaz turned to the altar of Slabatka. He sent them the Yudalit Talmidim. That put the yeshiva on the map. Among the Yudalit Talmidim was Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. He was, to use the Litvishi yeshiva aphorism, the Arisha B'chabura. He later takes Reb Aaron Cutler as a son-in-law. And Reb Aaron brings Slutsk, Kletzk to America. That is Lakewood. and Lakewood today, which arguably is the largest Torah institution in the United States with unbelievable influence, is a direct result going back to Rabbi Yaakov David Ben Zev Volovsky. Okay. Let's not forget it. Second thing that the Ritbans did, he wrote a double commentary on the Yerushalmi. Go into the Beis Medrash, you'll see what I'm saying. One commentary resembled Rashi, just Perish HaMilat, Perish HaShurat. The other commentary was much deeper, and it resembled Tosfot. In order to publish this commentary, he needed a fortune of money. Now here too, his genius works in his favor, or it works against him. Most people are very happy to sit still. What are we going to travel for? I'm going to see the world. Who wants the world? I'm happy here. I make a living. I have a wife. I have children. I have a shul. I have a mikvah. I have a kiddush group. I have a lashon hara group. What do I need more? The Ritbans got the travel bug. Got to raise money, got to travel. Went to Paris, went to Berlin. They're legendary stories. When he went to Berlin, the Rebbe used to tell stories. He met the great Rabbanim, and he traveled, and in the Berlin crowd, and the Rothschild crowd, and he raised money. Published the Yerushalmi. Like everything else, it cost more than they originally told them. What is the word they use? Overruns? What's the word? Overcosts? Give me the right English word. Overcost? Cost
overrun.
Cost overrun, whatever. You got the idea. Now he had to travel again. He went to America in 1900. Went to America. He saw Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. He saw his suffering. He traveled to a number of communities in America, including Chicago. Wherever he went, he rebuked the people for emigrating to America. And in an address he gave at the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations, which had just been organized in 1898, he quoted, he said one sentence that came back to haunt him. And he yelled and shouted at the people that you came to a land, Avu Afilu Deshtena Zion Treif. Translation means nothing. You have to understand the halacha. Even the stones are treif. What does that mean? When you kasha, what do you do when you're kashering a pot? You throw in, you take a stone, you heat it up with water, you take tongues, you lift up the stone, and you throw it into the pot. The water should overflow. Right or wrong? Kashering a pot. Today we don't kasher. Today, Baruch Hashem, we're wealthy enough that for Pesach we have separate kelim. But you'll see on the streets of Jerusalem, all over Israel, people are kashering. You know, it's a big industry here. And they tell me in Borough Park, they also, is it true or not? They tell me in Brooklyn, you can still see kashering going on. But here it's mamish, a big industry. All right, I'm a wealthy man. I don't kasher anything for Pesach. Everything I have, kainai and harid, and kiddush cups for Pesach. I still remember people kashering. All right, kiddush cup is not a big deal to kasher. But what about glassware where you drink whiskey and schnapps and scotch? And so you use stones to kasher. So here he's saying, even the stones are treif. That's how bad America is. He gave drashot all over, and the people laughed at his drashot. Why? Eisenstein, this Otsa Zichron Natai, is very insightful. Yehuda Davarai, very insightful. He says, why did the people laugh? Because when he dashened, he spoke slowly. He didn't yell. He didn't shout. He had contents. He developed ideas. What were the Jews on the east side used to? Dashanim yelling and screaming at them, right? You don't know this. You ever heard the old-time American Dashanim yelling, screaming, maledicting the audience, cursing? I mean, I saw in my youth, I can tell you, I once saw a sight, if you want to know, an old type of Dashan in 1977. I visited America for the first time. I never thought I would see America again when I went on holiday. I was a poor kid, had nothing with my wife, and I was a total idealist. Fine. The government of Israel sends me back now to address the RCA convention. So my first Shabbos in America, I stayed with my parents in Pelham Park, where they had moved from Washington Avenue to Pelham Park. It's the first time I ever was in there in Pelham Park. I never slept there. I was married. I was out of New York when they moved. Here I am in Pelham Park, so I go to the Young Israel. And I see in the Young Israel, the front row are Europeish of Balabatim, and they're staring at the rabbi with hatred. And I see this famous rabbi, no longer alive. I taught three of his four children. His widow lives in Yerushalayim, remarried a number of times since. And she was divorced from him at the end. And he gets up. And he starts shouting at the Balabatim, his Pashat Korach. We learn, the Midrash tells us, B'nei Korach lo mesu, the kinder from Korach of Nishkishtabin, they sitzen door and cooking meat on. And he's shouting, I gotta translate your law. The children of Korach didn't die. They're sitting in front of me and looking at me now. And he's yelling and shouting, and the Balabatim want to kill him, you know. But that's what the Balabatim are used to. I heard rushes like that. They yell, shout. But there's no content. But the Balabatim love it. You can't fall asleep. The Slutska Rav had content, but his delivery was slow, sure, calm, very fascinating. And he's in America, and he's overwhelmed by what he sees. He later writes, Shelet and Shuvan, he writes a long introduction about the American scene. He describes, first of all, imagine you're coming to the United States. You're being greeted at Ellis Island by the Jewish welfare committees, what functioned under the Hayas. And here they have a kosher kitchen, and you see the people greeting you sit down to eat bread without Netilat Yadayim, without making a bracha. He describes it. Then he says, let alone brachas, let alone Netilat Yadayim, there was the Industrial Removal Office. Now that's a technical term for a governmental body that was functioned with the Jews, run by the Jews. What was behind the Industrial Removal Office? Any of you know? Any of you ever hear about this? What were they worried about? Too many Jews would wind up in New York. The East Side wasn't big enough to hold 1,500,000 East European Jews. So the Industrial Removal Office, removal, where there's industry, where you can find jobs. So they took Jews and they sent them, greenhorns, all over the United States. Now their intentions were good, their intentions were wonderful. And their taka was industry, and there were jobs. And there were other Eastern European Jews there. But what about Shabbat? In New York you had a fight and be moise and nefesh to observe Shabbat. What about in other cities where the Jew was batel b'shishim and the entire economy was geared to a six-day work week? Shabbat was doomed. And he says this is why there was so much chilul Shabbat. There is no chance. And this, I want to tell you in parentheses, this will also explain to you why East European Rabbanim wound up all over the United States. Remember, I've often spoken about the greatest Rav ever to set foot in America, ever to live in America, was Rabbi Yehuda Leib Feuer, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik stood up with offer him. Rav Leizer Suva didn't paskin a difficult shaila without consulting Rav Yehuda Leib Feuer. Rav Moshe Soloveitcher called him the greatest bucky alive in our generation. The Meitzer Teilis Chavruta was Rav Yehuda Leib Feuer. Why did he wind up in Holyoke? Because in all of these communities, Pittsburgh, Detroit, these are well-known communities, but in endless little shtet, there were East European Jews. Mahalalei Shabbos worked on Shabbos, but when they built the shul, it was at that time a shul like they knew from Europe, what you call an Orthodox shul. And the Rav had to be a East European Rav. And that's how Rabbanim wound up. It's all due to the Industrial Removal Office. Had all the Jews remained in New York and Newark and Philadelphia, you wouldn't have had hundreds of Rabbanim spread out all over the United States.
Does Sana or anyone else write about this?
Anyone who deals with the history of Jews in America has to deal with the Industrial Removal Office. But from what I just told you now, I've never seen anyone else write. I mean, I'm just, from my point of view as a Torah Jew, as someone who knew Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael, as someone who shivers and shakes when he mentions Rabbi Yehuda Leib Feuer, immediately people look at you, what was he doing in Holyoke? They're laughing.
There's no great shakes in New York either, because I told people if you work...
No. But in New York, at least you had thousands who were Shomer Shabbos. You had tens of thousands who weren't, but at least there was... That, this is the big attack on Chaim Soloveitchik, on Dr. Grach. When he published Ruption Reconstruction, a lot of people were offended. They said, my parents, and then they this one, and it's true. But that was New York. In Boston, you remember what the Ruff said? When he came to Boston, he said there were just three or four individuals above the age of 13 and under the age of 70 who were Shomer Shabbos. And he said, all these people became my brothers-in-law. All one married Tanya's sister. What was his name? You know, the math professor at YU. Tanya Soloveitchik's sister. She was a Levitt. His name? Boy, our minds are blanking out. We have to check it out. Look at a Masmid from the 50s, the 60s. You'll see who he was. And then one married Ann Gerber. And one married Meiselman, Shulamit Meiselman. And one married his wife's sister. And that's it. That's it. That's all there was. This was all over. All right. Let me make one more point. One more point. Not only that.
It was Professor Isaacs.
Professor Adina at Harvard. Right. He was a Shomer Shabbos. That is true. The Isaacs family until today is all over. Basically, most of the family is here today. Kanayim Hara. It's unbelievable because that's a family that arrived in America in the 1860s, Civil War time. Or right after the Civil War. That's a very unique distinction, the Isaacs family. And his brother was basically dean of Yeshiva College. The 30s after Sapphire, 30s into the 40s. After Sapphire, he was dean of Yeshiva College. They're a very interesting family. At first identified with Agudat Yisrael, and later the family became Zionists. It's a fascinating family. But anyway, be it as it may, there might have been exceptions that they were few and very far between. And it's a very interesting point that the Ridbaz makes. The Industrial Removal Office put Jews all over the United States. And it's not that they meant anything negative. You had industry, you had jobs, you had cousins there. And go, no, if you're in a city with 10,000 Jews and there's not one Shomer Shabbos, what chance do you have to be a Shomer Shabbos? New York was New York. Philadelphia was better. Newark was better. But beyond that, wow.
Well, this is really a fascinating doctrine. Yeah. Anybody listening?
Yeah, no. There's a lot of history of American Jewry. There's a world that can be done. And the Ridbaz, maybe more research can be done. I don't know. I don't know if I exhausted it. I don't know what remains anymore. But okay, we'll get there. I want to make one more point. The Ridbaz also was totally opposed to the English language. He was overwhelmed when he came into Hebrew schools and they're teaching the kids the Tanakh in English. And he pleaded with parents, don't send your children to schools where the Tanakh is taught in English. His attitude was, as they taught me in Lakewood, the Torah was given in Yiddish. The Ribbono Shel Olam had geret Lisman. Lisman was the name we were looking for. The Rav's brother, what was his first name? Also, you got Lisman, Professor Lisman. He was the Rav's brother-in-law. We knew him as Professor Lisman, but it would be interesting to go back to a Musman and see what his first name was. He was the Rav's brother-in-law, taught at YU. He was married to Tanya's sister, Tanya's younger sister. So it's very fascinating. Torah was given in Yiddish. Moshe Rabbeinu geret Yiddish mit Ribbono Shel Olam. So can you sign under it? It can't be any other way. And he was convinced that if you don't study in Yiddish, you can't get Yiret Shemayim. He was so opposed to the use of English that you will find, and I give you sources in my public scholarship, everything I'm saying I give you sources for, he warned the people that if a rabbi gets up to speak in English, you should walk out. These sermons contain no true guidance for the Jewish people, he said. They simply make the Jewish people like the rest of the nations. If this practice will not cease, there is no hope for the continuance of the Jewish religion. These sermons open up the gates leading our brethren to reform Judaism. Whoever fears the Lord must protest against these preachers. If one does not have the power to stop this practice, he must leave the synagogue when such a preacher ascends the pulpit. Due to our sins, this practice is now becoming widespread, even in Orthodox synagogues. The masses do not realize the graveness of the danger this presents to Judaism. So here you have the Ritvaz. Here he is in the United States. Here he is castigating the use of the English language. Here he is describing the breakup of Kashrut and Shabbat. And very quickly, he returns to Slutz. But wanderlust was now part of him. Debts were still owed on the Yerushalmi. And as you will see, 2-3 years later, he returns to the United States as the chief rabbi of Chicago. So what have we done today? First of all, we skirmished with Yonah Landau and the Rav HaKollel. Fascinating volume. It makes you happy for what he uncovers, and it causes you anguish for the lack of a proper scholarly approach, turning names around, Sabbato Marius, Shabtai Marius, go and figure out who he's talking about. His take on the R.H. Ho Company and the Divine Retribution, it's a fact about the General Slocum, but the Divine Retribution, Hanistarat LaShem Elokeinu, and we'll leave it at that. Nevertheless, R.J.J. paves the way for the Ritvaz. The Ritvaz in Europe, tremendous Talmud Chacham, Tana Dirushalmi, Perish opens Dirushalmi. Until today, his edition of Dirushalmi is the most basic edition. Now, with what's happening in Israel and all the modern work and the modern scholarship, the Ritvaz's edition fades into memory. But in its time, for more than 120, 130 years, it was the Yerushalmi. More than anything else, he organizes the Slutsk Yeshiva, and we benefit greatly from it, from Slutsk to Kletz to Lakewood. And ask any Lakewood boy if he knows his own history, and if he tells you he learns in Lakewood, tell him you don't know what you're talking about, you're learning in Kletsk. And when he repeats to you he learns in Kletsk, tell him you don't know what you're talking about, you're learning in Slutsk. and see if he follows you. Find out if he has a picture of the Altar of Slabodka on his wall, because he owes the greatness of Lakewood to the Altar of Slabodka and the Yud Dalad Chazakah. He visits America 1900. I gave you his impressions, and Be'ezrat HaNotein Le'Yaakov Kolch will pick up exactly here on next Monday. This past Sunday, I apologize, but you also, no one corrected me when I said we're meeting on Sunday. No one said to me, Rebbe, it's Asara B'Tavis. But I was so busy with my mother's yard site that when I realized it's Asara B'Tavis, I put up the sign in the Beis Medrash, which, thank God, reached all of you. And I trust no one came in vain on Sunday. We pick up Sunday unbelievable material. I'm in a very happy mood because I've now, the yard site is over, the availit is over. So it's on the house. As a matter of fact, I'm even going to be more generous. Anyone who comes Sunday, 36,000 added to the IOU list. The Rebbe owes you for coming. Now, gentlemen, first of all, this volume came out. It's a little volume pamphlet. It's written by my nephew. The volume is dedicated in memory of my mother. Maimat ha'isha al-pia yadud biru'a ma'amik b'mamit ha'isha v'ish b'chevra ha'madnit v'havana ha'interaksia shebeinehem. The interaction. Harav Ilan Tzipori married to my niece Ilana. Ilana and Ilan. Rothkopf to Tzipori. In back is a little biography of my mother. If anyone reads Hebrew and is interested in the topic, which any Jew walking the face of the earth should be, please enjoy. For Yitzchak, 1 second. But I want you to do something. There's a commentary on a Rambam. Check it out and see what you come up with. And 1 second. Mori, this is for you. Now, I want you to see what activism is. Rabbi Rubin wrote a letter to Richard Joel, which is worth reading. We hope what Yitz suggests will be done. If anyone wants a copy, that's that letter. Here's an article that appeared. I'd like your reaction. I was frightened by it. Filibusters around the town, ultra-Orthodox women wigging out in Jerusalem. If you haven't seen the article, this is, I believe, from Israel. This is from Haaretz. If you're interested, it's a fascinating article, and it raises the issue, which they don't discuss, what the Balei Tshuva have done to the Haredi world. Fascinating article.
The wigs now, are more sexy than
the one second. Now, this is very fascinating. What has become of the conservative movement vis-a-vis Kashrut? It will blow your mind what has become of the conservative movement. I thank Josh Schneider for sending it to me. I thank Josh Schneider. This is an article on Eliyahu Soloveitchik, the Soloveitchik who loved Jesus and wrote a book. Okay. Oh, you don't know this? This is...
Well, you mentioned it, but
that... Yeah, and this is about his teachings, the book, all brought to the fore by his descendant, Soloway, who's the head of Yale University. My dear students, until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya.
Yeah.